from the Gettysburgian and 91.1 WZBT Gettysburg, I'm Ben Ponce, and this is On Target.
I'm Gari Mangala, and today on Target, we will be discussing the introduction of the 15th president to Gettysburg College and a recent faculty meeting.
Then we'll play a portion of my interview with that new president of Gettysburg College, Robert Iuliano. Stay with us. All right, let's get into it. We have a new president, and he visited campus this weekend. Gari.
So for full transparency, Ben and I were having a discussion right before he turned on the record button about what we would start with on the news segment. And I was suggesting whether or not I pitch it to him or he pitches it to me. And then he hit the play button and pitched it to me without me knowing.
I'm nothing if not decisive.
Yeah.
Maybe we should change my middle name to that.
BDP?
I don't know. I'm thinking about either decisive or efficiency.
How would your mother feel about you changing your name?
It's more my father that I'd be concerned about because it's currently his name, which is Robert.
Yeah, we'll see what happens with that.
That was an aside.
Speaking of Robert, hey,
There it is right there.
Speaking of Robert, we have a new president-elect, the 15th president of Gettysburg College, who will start July 1st, if I believe, Robert W. Iuliano.
Goes by Bob.
He goes by Bob, as we've heard. He
numerous
has made
times.
At least two jokes yesterday that I heard about changing his initials to JMR to jumpstart on that good old love that we have for JMR. But we also have... I have seen jokes about calling him BWI, so we'll see how that goes.
Ooh, I like that.
You like BWI?
I mean, the airport's okay, but yes, I think we should start...
There's an airport called BWI?
Yeah, the Baltimore Airport is BWI.
Oh,
that's
okay.
Let's start that. We're going to do that. That's going to be the Gettysburgian's contribution.
That wasn't the Gettysburgian. I saw it on the meme page. So,
well, that's, on whose page?
On the meme, the Gettysburg. You're not on the Gettysburg College Facebook meme page, Ben?
Let me tell you, you better believe it's not beneath me to steal from some page called the Gettysburg College meme page and take credit for it myself. Yes, I work at Musselman Library, but I'm not counting that as plagiarism.
Okay, well, I saw it on a post by James Lamb, I think it was. So, James, if you're listening, I just gave you credit. But it was on the meme page. I'm going to add Ben to it tonight so that he gets spammed. So the president was introduced to campus and the community yesterday. We are recording this on Saturday, February 9th at 4:30, if anyone cares about the time. Ben and I are both sick and drained, so I'm sorry for this somewhat nasally episode.
No, I think you're sick and I'm drained. But,
exactly. relatively speaking. So we met with the president yesterday. We recorded a Facebook Live interview. I was behind the camera and Ben was interviewing Bob Iuliano. And he was very gracious. He was very sweet. He asked us all, like, what each of us do for the newspaper. He asked you how we print.
Yeah, no, he was very interested in the mechanics of printing a newspaper, and it gave me an opportunity to express my less than pleasure with our current printer.
Yeah, apologies to who is the bullet shot of the week?
Alec Warren of the men's basketball team. Yeah, Alec, I'm assuming that the men's basketball team is probably not the most avid listening constituency of On Target. But, there was some issue with some ink splotchage. I don't know if splotchage is a word.
Splatter?
I suppose. I kind of like splotchage, though. Yeah. In any case, yeah, there was some ink splotchage on his face in some of the print editions. But anyway, it was a good interview, I thought.
Yeah,
and
me too.
We'll play it later in this program, We'll see how it goes. I mean, every comment I have heard thus far about the new president has either been neutral or positive. I haven't heard anyone, with the exception of a handful of members of the Greek community at the college who are concerned, and he addresses this in the interview later, who are concerned about his posture towards Greek life, given what Harvard did in curtailing single-sex social organizations. Which is something that in a process in which he was involved, there's some concern about that. But other than that, I've heard really only positive things.
Yeah.
What about you?
Yeah, and I think your verbiage in using the term concerned is very appropriate in that it's not out of a place of, you know, definitely saying that he's going to make a certain decision. I think it's more just seeing his decisions at Harvard and wondering how they're going to transfer there. I spoke to him yesterday on the record, but not on the interview, about Greek life. And essentially his stance is that what worked for Harvard may not work for Gettysburg. And then I think in the interview, when you asked him about it, one of the things he said was, and that will come up later when we play the interview, was about making this a good place for student life at Gettysburg. And obviously, like, Harvard is not the same place as Gettysburg. It's a large university. We talked about this on Target last week. It's not going to be the same. And I think he's very well aware of that. And I think that's been something that he's really been trying to make clear that he's aware of. He said he was saying that in his speech. That was also live streamed, so if you weren't able to go attend the student reception, I guess we can call it, in Cup Ballroom at 8 yesterday, that's live streamed in the Gettysburg, on the Gettysburgian Facebook page, his remarks to the room. He did discuss that he wants to spend his first year really getting to know the campus and, I guess, establish the connections that JMR already had going into becoming president as she was a professor and before that a student. He's aware that, you know, he's at a disadvantage in coming in. And I think the fact that he's making it very clear, like he said, he's going on a listening tour, which is a term that I've just now at this point, because of the presidential search and they kept calling it a listening tour, I've just gotten used to hearing. And
well, Jennifer Blomquist last year with Freedom of Expression also went on a listening tour.
So I think we should start. I think we need to just create a listening tour map.
Yeah, there we go.
You know, just of where all you should head.
We're in April Fool's Gettysburgian compiling season, so I don't know. Maybe we can, you know, say that we've unearthed a map for listening tours and special collections. Listen to this iterative creative process happening before your eyes. I do want to say, with respect to the Greek issue, I also interviewed David Brennan and Charlie Scott, the chair and executive vice chair, respectively, of the Board of Trustees, and asked them the same question about the board's posture towards Greek life. And everyone, it kind of reminds me of Democratic politicians talking about gun control.
Mm.
It's essentially, before you can say anything that's a critique, you have to pay lip service in the case of Democrats and gun control. I'm a strong supporter of the Second Amendment, and I believe in hunting and blah, 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 blah.
Absolutely.
And with respect to Greek life, it's, I believe in the value of a social system on campus that provides, you know, and of course we know that in some cases it goes to, and so it reminds me of that. What I will say is that while we always pay lip service to the value of the Greek system, I think there is a reasonable argument to be made that what's good for the goose is good for the gander. In other words, that what has worked at other institutions, maybe, you know, at some point you need to cut the cord on this issue, and maybe the idea that elitist single-sex clubs don't belong on a campus committed to diversity and inclusion has some currency. I think that that's something that doesn't really get discussed out in the open as much. I think that Nick Arbaugh, the president of Student Senate, when he launched this Senate committee on Greek life that still does not seem to have gotten off the ground, hoped that conversation would happen out in the open, and it hasn't yet. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see. Maybe it will take a new president to launch a conversation of that nature. But I will say that something that Brennan and Scott mentioned, and they were both on this trustees task force that reviewed Greek life and the social experience more broadly, I believe it was last year at the college, you know, they said that they're not really interested in another round of dialogue, that they think they did a deep dive and that, you know, that the Greek situation such as it is what it is. And I asked them also, and I told them that I was going to put this as bluntly as it stated on campus, that there's a thought that a group of trustees composed by a plurality, if not a majority, of well-to-do white men that were in Greek organizations when they were students is not the most representative group to consider that system's future as the campus becomes increasingly diverse. Now, it's worth noting that Charlie Scott was not a member of a Greek organization when he was here, and he was on the trustees' Greek Life Committee. And it's also worth noting that the board has improved its diversity in the last couple of years in particular, and that there are a variety of people of color in senior positions on the board, just off the top of my head, Troy Datcher, Lauren Wise Bright, Jeff Banks are all, or excuse me, Jim Banks are all people of color in relatively senior positions on the board, chairing committees and such. But, you know, I think that there's also a perception that, you know, David Brennan, the chair of the board, was a member of SAE and has given a lot of money to the college, as have many of the board members, Bob Garthway. And so, you know, there's this suggestion on campus that seems to hold some currency. And I've spoken with historians, Michael Berkner in particular, who have said that presidents going back to the 70s and the 80s have felt a need to walk a tightrope, viewing any substantive reforms of the Greek system as a third rail. And so it'll be interesting to see how that manifests itself in the Iuliano presidency moving forward.
Well, that's there's also a lot of weight to the what you were saying about giving money. One thing being that a lot of people think that the reason that we toe such a line about Greek life is because of the money it brings in. We aren't a big research university like Harvard, so we can't in some ways afford to cut that cord. And the tradition is a thing. Tradition is something that people really take seriously, specifically at colleges like Gettysburg. I don't know how donors would react to like an SAE becoming co-ed or being removed from the college or being penalized if you are a part of in whatever form that would take place. It also, I think, is of note that JMR was in a sorority when she was here. I think she was in AOPI or CHIO or
CHIO.
Yeah, she was
in AOPI, only is 5 years old.
Apologies. I am not in Greek life.
I'm not either. I just happen to know.
Yeah, I think
facts.
I think if anyone who doesn't know Ben and I personally has not figured out at this point, Ben and I are both not in Greek life. So
nor do I have any desire to be. Let me be clear. I want to put something on the record here. Last year, when I wrote.
Oh, yeah. I think this is worth putting on the air, actually.
I wrote a series of articles regarding the 2017 Greek evaluations, which included reports on those organizations' conduct and GPAs, and that I'm going to say this. I think it was a fair story. I mean, we talked to members of Greek organizations and people in the Office of Student Activities and Greek Life about this, and I think we told a fair story.
Numbers don't lie.
Numbers do not, in fact, lie, including the number that new members of Fiji had an average GPA of 1.92. But anyway, we posted this article, and almost all of the comments that it received were, wow, here's someone with sour grapes that he didn't get a bid.
You didn't even rush. You didn't do any of the rush process.
You could not only did I not, you could not have paid me. You could have offered me a 5-digit amount of money, and I still would not. I had absolutely no desire to be involved. So, I just wanted to put that on the record that, you know, it's not that I have sour grapes. It's that I have, you know, an interest in
telling the truth.
In maybe basic facts and transparency.
On the subject of transparency,
I do want to just say that a couple of weeks ago, I went on a little bit of a tirade about the new website in which I suggested that that the aptitude of communications and marketing was not up to snuff. I should note that communications and marketing has done yeoman's work in a lot of areas, marketing and promoting the college, and that the website issues seem to have been unforeseen on their end and the result of some things a little bit outside their control. So I did go probably further than I should have in that particular rant, and I just wanted to mention that in a public setting, as I'd already conveyed it to Jamie Yates in a private setting, but I want to make sure that the apology is as public as the error. So there's that. Let's move on.
On to, I think, going back a little bit about the situation with the Greek life thing, I think that this new president, and I think I'm not, have we heard? I don't think he was in a fraternity, was he?
No. And I mean, it's also worth noting that Harvard has a very different Greek landscape, such that when we're talking about single-sex organizations, the single-sex organizations that Harvard was most interested in eradicating are these things called final clubs, which are essentially kind of secret societies that have been rather mysterious and that are rather exclusive to Ivy League institutions. I think Yale had them or maybe still has them. But that, Greek organizations, as we conceptualize them here at Gettysburg, were not the primary target of these reforms that were implemented at Harvard. But you know, if you're going to eliminate some of them, you have to eliminate all of them. Absolutely. Or target some of them. You have to target all of them. So anyway, no, I don't believe he was involved with that. But it's also not fair to say that that's an apples to apples comparison to what we have here.
And I also know that, like, I was talking to a friend of mine who does go to Harvard, and he was telling me that these finance clubs, regardless of the sanctions on them, are just bad news. He was saying that he just avoids them in general, which is not really the case with Greek life here. Yes, people do avoid going to certain fraternities, especially at nighttime, because they have bad, some of them do have bad reputations. I'm not going to name any on the air, but anyone who goes to Gettysburg College or is familiar with their social scene knows what I'm talking about. But that's, from what my friend told me, like, that's not what it's like there. It's not just not going there. You don't want to be involved with anybody who is a part of it or has any sense of what's going on, because people proudly wear their letters here. And that's something, you know, there's not a single person in Greek life here that you aren't completely aware is in Greek life or what fraternity or sorority they're in. But that is the case with some of these finals clubs at Harvard. So I don't think it's going to be a big deal. And I think for the people that go here now, I think it's similar to how when we talk about, like, climate change, it's not really going to affect you while you're here. I really don't.
Also, let me just say two final things about this. It's also the case at Gettysburg that students who are not in Greek organizations frequently attend social events at them, such as, well, you. But in any case, the other thing I wanted to say, it was something that Charlie Scott said at our interview on Friday, which is that he had two kids who graduated from here, one in 2009 and one in 2012, and his daughter in 2009 was in a sorority, and his son in 2012 was in a fraternity, and both of them were convinced at the time that the administration was going to take an axe to Greek life. And his take is that it's essentially a fact of life that Greek life feels targeted, but that he, from the Board of Trustees perspective, and David Brennan corroborated this from his angle too, that there's no plan on the Board of Trustees or in hiring someone who did something at Harvard to translate that to Gettysburg. Let's move on.
Speaking of change, perhaps.
What are we changing now?
There was a faculty meeting that happened recently.
That's an even worse transition.
I'm trying my best.
So at this week's faculty meeting, the faculty voted, and effective with the class of 2024, which is not the class that enters this fall, but the fall of 2020, students will be required to participate in first-year seminars. To date, about 95% of students have, but there are some key groups, particularly athletes, male athletes in particular, and international students that participate at rather low rates comparatively. And so the first-year seminar committee, which is chaired by Darren Glass, the math professor, brought forward this motion to essentially make first-year seminars mandatory, and if a student fails a first-year seminar or withdraws, there will be another seminar offered in the spring that they'll then have to enroll in, or they can take another course to satisfy the requirement that the first-year seminar committee will approve based on the learning outcomes associated with first-year seminars, such as culminating projects and discussion-based classes and that sort of thing. So that passed far from unanimously, although not particularly close either. I believe the final tally was something like 88-53 with a handful of abstentions. A lot of the conversation focused on particular carve-outs for majors and programs in which that would be problematic. Music education is one of them. You can read the article that we wrote about this. I spoke with Brooke Maskin, who is a music education major who has a minor in Spanish, and she said that to make that work, given the number of class openings that the music education program has in order to comply with state licensing requirements for teachers, that she had to take a lab science course at a community college over the summer. So I don't think her case is particularly an outlier, although she's currently the only music education major pursuing a minor that is not peace and justice studies. And that works because peace and justice studies has some education courses that count towards the minor, so they can kind of double in that regard and have enough courses to take out. I think the other major that was mentioned as a possible one that might need an alternate consideration was biochemistry, molecular biology, BMB, as it's called.
But those two majors are the ones we tend to hear a lot about having a larger amount of credits. In both of those cases, it's because they're two disciplines wrapped into one, education and music and biochemistry and molecular biology. So, and I'm not saying that that's something to look at the majors rather than this requirement, but maybe that is something. Like, maybe the departments should be looking at how much they're asking from their students, and if it's relatively fair that, you know, you're coming out with a single major, but you've really done a double major requirement.
That's an interesting point. You know, it's the case that for music education, it is a different degree. It is a bachelor's of music education.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And, you know, the biochemistry, molecular biology it's a bachelor of science degree in biochemistry and molecular biology. So, you know, it's one of those things that is, there was a little bit of discussion about it. I think it's likely down the line that an accommodation of some sort will be made. Russ McCutcheon, associate professor of music and director of bands, who's also a music education faculty member, said on Thursday that, you know, maybe it can just be that music education majors are required to take a first-year seminar that meets the first-year writing requirement so that they can kill those two birds with one stone. And so, you know, I think there are a variety of ways that can transpire. It was interesting, though, that there was not really a lot of substantive commentary on the value educationally of first-year seminars. It was kind of a foregone assumption that everyone went in with, that there is inherent value to having that kind of experience in your first year. And there is a good amount of academic research to support that point. It also improves student retention rates to some extent to have that first year seminar experience. And so it'll be interesting to see how this goes moving forward. Supposedly, this will not require adding any more first-year seminar sections, that it can already be accommodated within the current number that tends to be offered, which is right around 50 to 51. Sometimes, I think Darren Glass said it's been between, I'm going to get these numbers wrong, but say 48 and 53 over the last 5 years.
And part of that does have to do with, like, what classes end up not happening because of a lack of people picking. I know that the first year seminar that I took, my year was not offered this year, but like it was offered as a choice, but then only four people ended up selecting it. It was multicultural theater in the United States, and that ended up not being selected because only four people signed up and only 10 signed up my year.
Yeah.
So there's something to be said about the fact that
my first year seminar was a real popular class and still is a popular one. It's the Bush administration. When I took it, it was the Bush administration's approach to terror and torture, a real riveting subject. And then subsequently, it's been recast as How the White House Works. But in any case, my first year, 20 of us signed up for it. Now, there's a cap of 16. It worked out because 10 people ended up dropping out of 20, which was a remarkable retention rate. But in any case, you know, I think that there are a large number of first-year seminars that have a lot of people that sign up for that as their first choice. Henning Vraga in the German department teaches one on, I think, espionage and film or something. Something like 50 students put that as their first choice this year. And so obviously not all of them could get it. But, you know,
I know that Vern Sisney's in the philosophy department is very popular.
Yeah, that's another popular one.
Plato, Personhood, and Popcorn. I probably switched the order up. My roommate, my first year.
Yeah, but that's
that one.
Film and philosophy, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's film and philosophy, but it's taught by Vern Sisney, who is in the philosophy department, I should clarify. I have a question for you, though, because I know this is different for different majors. You are a poli-sci and public policy double major. Did your FYS count towards an elective credit in either of your majors?
My first year seminar can be taken in place of poli-sci 101, which is American government. Now, I already had an AP credit coming in for American government, so for me, it didn't meet any additional requirements, although I think I counted that course instead of my AP credit so I could get the grade that I got in my course factored in my GPA and everything rather than losing it.
But that makes sense.
In certain ones do and certain ones don't. And so every first-year seminar, though, does meet at least one of the college's curriculum goals, whether it's, you know, a humanities credit, whether it's first year writing, whether it's science, technology, society, it meets a requirement of the Gettysburg curriculum. So the point was emphasized that this does not add another class requirement for students because they already all meet a requirement that students would have to meet anyway if they don't take a seminar.
So then by that logic, especially for the MUSEDs and the BMBs, it would make sense to just take an FYS that would count towards another major. For example, for the BMB specifically, like taking an arts one or a humanities one will kill out that credit. And like, that's a class you're already going to have to take. Obviously, there's exceptions to kids who take a lot of AP credits and blah, 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 blah. Maybe you have a minor. But for the most part, I know that there's always a couple of requirements that every double major, single major, double minor, whatever you are. Like for me, for example, I'm going to have a tough time knocking out my math credit. Like there's nothing for my majors or minor that's really going to knock that out. Specific also with my science requirement. I think you're in the same boat that your science requirement is something you have to take separately unless you have an AP credit.
Taking AP physics in high school was the best decision I ever made.
There we
go.
There it is. So I don't think it's out of the question to say that it's impossible because I know that just because you're a Muse Ed and even if you have a different minor than Peace and Justice, like you have classes that you have to take so your FYS can knock it out. But I also know that there's like a scheduled time for Muse Eds where I don't think that's the case for BMBS as much as it is for
the issue with Music Ed is that you have to take a first year writing requirement in your first semester and a math credit. There are state requirements of when you have to take courses. In addition to that, you have to take them, I believe.
Oh, you can't like knock it out with like an AP or an SAT?
You can, but I think it depends. There are different rules about how some of that works. And the point that was made in the faculty meeting was that it's the sequencing that's more challenging for that than, you know, the actual taking of the course.
That's valid.
The other topic that was raised at the faculty meeting, and we're not going to get too much into this today, is that there's a motion from APPC, the Academic Policy and Program Committee, to make online hybrid courses over the summer a permanent fixture in the Gettysburg College curriculum. So there have been three consecutive summers in which they've been offered as pilots. The data is in. APPC believes that it's worth pursuing permanently, and it is something that they moved. They presented a motion to the faculty to make that a permanent part of the curriculum, and several faculty members had several questions. Veronique De La Sella in the biology department questioned whether those faculty who teach them, why they're compensated at the rate they are in comparison to particularly STEM faculty that mentor summer research. And there are some equity issues there in her mind. The response to that was, well, technically all faculty are on a 9-month contract. That prompted a range of oohing and aahing that, you know, that my summers aren't my own. And while that's probably the case, particularly one faculty member in the STEM fields mentioned that, you know, the ex-sig program has become such a selling point for the college such that if faculty decided to stop teaching, or excuse me, to stop mentoring research in that in favor of teaching, that they would lose kind of that marketable opportunity to do summer research, particularly in the STEM fields. We're going to talk in a future episode to Bill O'Hara, assistant professor of music, who taught an online course, a hybrid course. They're not totally online. There's usually some face-to-face interaction or some synchronous component. But in any case, we're going to talk to him about his experience teaching his course on video game music online in the future. And probably that's about all the time we have to get into that today. Did you take any online? Have you taken any online classes before, Gari?
No, I haven't.
I took two in high school AP online credits, and they were both mostly disasters.
My mom took them when she was going. My mom took her master's when I was in like middle school and high school, and she took a couple, but she didn't like them.
Yeah, they're common in graduate programs.
Yeah,
you know, the point that's been raised is that this provides needed flexibility to students.
I think so.
The counterpoint raised to that was, well, you're allowed to take up to three of them. That means you would only have to overload once to be able to graduate a semester early. And then the revenue that the college recoups, because the basic premise is that students are taking these courses anyway, often at community colleges or whatever. So let's have them take them at Gettysburg so we can get the revenue.
Yeah.
But the counterpoint to that is if we let students take this many credits and transfer them or take this many credits, then they're just going to graduate a semester earlier. I mean, if the supposition is that they're transferring them in anyway, I don't think that particular argument holds weight. But, you know, it's an argument that was raised, and I think it's something that a lot of faculty take seriously. I don't anticipate this passing on a heads or tails vote based on what I saw this week, at least not unanimously or anywhere close. I think that there's still an opportunity for faculty to make the case and APPC to make the case that this is the right move. But there was a lot of skepticism in the room on a lot of fronts.
I think that I get the whole, like, graduating a semester early is probably something they don't want. But, like, we are both double majors with a minor. And I know that Ben has this insane Excel spreadsheet, and I have a bunch of different, like, notepads of all the classes I need to take to graduate with all of my requirements, both my Gettysburg requirements and for my majors and my minor. And I think for us, it just means that we don't have to take five classes at some point. And I think that is the case for some kids of not wanting to take five classes. And that's not something that's recommended. I remember I took five classes my first semester here, and I had a call from one of the deans, like, are you sure you want to do this? But I think for some students, that would be helpful. And beyond the whole, let's bank the money from somebody taking a summer class, also, that means that they can stay with the Gettysburg education and the Gettysburg mindset, and they're with Gettysburg professors. And at the end of the day, that's more important than working with a professor at a community college that you don't go to.
Yeah, and that was another point that was raised. All right, I think that's about going to wrap up our news segment. We'll be right back with the Bullet Report, followed by our interview with President-elect Bob Giuliano. Stay with us. It's time for the Bullet Report. It's been a fairly exciting week in Gettysburg College sports action. On February the 2nd, the men's wrestling team lost to Ursinus 26-13. The men's wrestling team defeated Muhlenberg 29-20. The same day, the women's swimming team lost to Swarthmore 134-128. On the 2nd, the men's swimming team lost 135.5 to 126.5. The same day, the women's basketball team defeated Swarthmore 75-54. The men's basketball team lost to Swarthmore 99-60. The women's basketball team defeated Ursinus 82-70 on February the 5th. The men's basketball team defeated McDaniel in a nail biter 75-74 against McDaniel. The men's swimming team defeated Dickinson 116-84. The women's swimming team defeated Dickinson 114-90 the same day. The women's basketball team defeated McDaniel 74-46. The men's swimming team lost to Franklin and Marshall 133-29. The women's swimming team defeated Franklin and Marshall 139-122. The women's basketball team defeated Washington College 64-38. Thus endeth the Bullet Report.
That must have been a new record for speed with 49 seconds of the Bullet Report.
Well, I'm nothing if not efficient. We'll be right back with President-elect Robert Giuliano. Here live in this new room in the College Union building, and we're here with our new college president, Robert Giuliano, who's joining us in July. He'll take over from President Janet Morgan Riggs, and he's currently general counsel at Harvard, and we're thrilled that he was able to join us for this first exclusive live interview here with the Gettysburg Campus Community. Great to have you here.
Well, Ben, thank you for having me. Looking forward to our conversation today. Looking forward to getting to know this community better over the course of the coming weeks and months. So, thank you.
Yeah, so I know that you're on a bit of a whirlwind tour of campus, so let's dive right into the questions. You're currently at Harvard, and you decided to apply to become the president of Gettysburg College. Why Gettysburg, and why now?
Well, I am here, I think, for the same reasons that most of the students are here, and that is there is something captivating about this place. There is something about the spirit of the college, something about the community that it builds, something about the transformational opportunities it makes available to its students. So I've now taught at Harvard for close to 20 years in addition to my other responsibilities, and I've done that because of a deep belief in both the power of education, but also just the pleasure I get out of interacting with students and seeing the growth and transformation that follows from that. So the opportunity to come to this particular community and to work more closely with the students and the faculty to advance this institution's particular mission, which I find so uplifting, I found quite compelling. And again, you all have chosen to come here for many of the same reasons that I have chosen to be here. And so I'm absolutely thrilled.
Had you visited Gettysburg College before? Had you been here before?
I was here, in fact. There was a great, you know, the search committee necessarily was trying to keep the search confidential.
Right.
That was important because you want people who are able to explore this fully. But I came down not all that long ago, and I was walking through the campus. You all were on vacation, but lo and behold, I ran into a member of the search committee. And so we were all saying, oh no, is this the end of confidentiality? But the member handled it with skill and with grace. My son had visited Gettysburg with his mom, and we have a big file at home. I have to admit, I shouldn't say this, ended up not applying. He preferred to be closer to home.
And so many of the plaudits from the members of the search committee in the immediate aftermath of the announcement was your deep commitment to the liberal arts. And given that you've been at Harvard and that you went to law school at UVA, which are two very large institutions, where did you develop this affinity for the liberal arts, and how will that manifest itself in your presidency?
So two things. One is, remember at the beating heart of Harvard University is Harvard College. And Harvard College is a liberal arts college, and it's my alma mater. And so I was very much oriented to the intellectual possibilities that a liberal arts education offers by virtue of my own experience. But I was talking with the administrative and support councils today, and I recounted the following story, so just bear with me for a moment. But a singular moment in my life was when I was given the opportunity to attend a small New England prep school on a full scholarship. Came about in a way I won't go into, just given the time that we have. But it had 82 or 83 students per class. And the 3 years I spent there, in an intimate scale, where I really knew all of my classmates, where I got to interact with the faculty in ways that were not imaginable to me in the school system that I was in. Intellectual, the cultural, the social horizons that it opened, to me, were defining moments of my life. So you combine my deep and abiding belief in the importance of a liberal arts education with that experience of what an intimate educational scale offers, and again, the notion of being able to take what I had learned from my 25 years in higher education and applying it to this campus was a compelling one for me.
What do you think are some of the major challenges facing Gettysburg College, and what are kind of the top areas that you want to explore when you take over in July?
So I really like the way you phrased that question, and that is, let me emphasize the word explore. So my first responsibility, Ben, is to listen, to understand, to have conversations, to be informed by conversations like you and I are having, but also with the faculty, with the trustees, with the alumni, with other students, with the parents. Every institution has its own identity and its own culture and its own values. I have a good sense of those, but I'd like to deepen my understanding of that. And the way to do that is for me to listen very carefully. And so what I will choose to do will very much be informed by what I hear in the conversations that I want. Now that said, there are certain things we know we need to do. The work that the college has done in diversifying the campus remains a central priority for me. And that means not only changing the demographic characteristics of the campus, but making sure that every student, socioeconomically, geographically, racially, finds that this is a place where they can do their best work, where they are full members of the community. So that's an essential aspect of what we're going to do. We need to make sure that we are providing you all with the most dynamic education that we can, which means stepping back and asking ourselves, is the curriculum oriented the way we want it to be? What are the pedagogical tools we should be employing to make sure that they're speaking to you in a way that works? So there's a set of those issues that need to be done. This is a nationally recognized and prestigious institution. We want to broaden the footprint yet more. And like every educational institution, we need to make sure we have the resources to do that and to do it in a way that will be most effective. So there are all of those begin to create a shape of the issues that I want to explore. But again, I'm going to be informed by what I hear based on the conversations I intend to have.
Mm-hmm. And as I'm sure you're aware, one issue that had, I guess, last year transfixed campus was that of freedom of expression. You probably know that there was a process led by Associate Provost Jennifer Bloomquist to draft a statement of institutional philosophy on that issue. What would you say your attitude is towards freedom of expression, and then more specifically the statement and the process that was used to develop it?
So let me start with the first half of the question, and that is, let's remember what we're about. We are fundamentally an institution that is designed to help examine ideas and use that fulcrum of an education to ask questions about where we are as a society, who we want to be as individuals, how we fit into the broader good. And we get there by virtue of testing assumptions. We get there by the exchange of ideas. We get there, in fact, by the contest of ideas as well. I would regret to be at an institution where there's a sense of orthodoxy. You want to be at an institution where conversations are open, where people have the capacity to ask hard questions, even unpopular questions. Oftentimes, the most unpopular questions may turn out to lead to new discoveries. I'll give the rather well-worn example of Galileo, who had a view of the universe that was not consistent with the orthodoxy. We don't want to be in a position where just because something might be seen as unusual or out of bounds, it is suppressed. And so I think that the statement and the philosophy that it underlies speaks not just to a luxury, but to an indispensable necessity of what an educational institution has to be. We have to be a place in which ideas get contested, in which they get debated, and where we can have smart conversations. But let me also underscore that set of principles that were also reflected in this statement, and that is to do so in a way that is mutually supportive, that is constructive, that is, I'm going to quote from the now president of the University of Virginia, but a friend of mine, who, in a conversation I had with him, talked about the concept of generous listening, giving everybody the benefit of the doubt. So we want to be a community where these ideas get fully explored, but they do so in a way that is respectful of the differences that we bring to the table, and the fact that people in good faith can disagree about the way they look at the world. That's the alchemy of a good education, and so I think the college got it right.
Mm-hmm. You alluded to this a little bit earlier, but Gettysburg College, to provide the type of educational experience it wants to, needs a large amount of money, we'll just put it that way. And as I'm sure you know, the college just completed a $160 million capital campaign. You may have, folks watching may have noticed that in our introductory article about me, we mentioned that Harvard just completed a $9.6 billion campaign. Now, obviously, that's not an apples-to-apples comparison, but what lessons from Harvard's fundraising or other areas in your background would you bring to the role of being Gettysburg College's chief fundraiser as president?
So, a couple of things. First, you're right, it's not apples to apples. It's Harvard is a large research university that has 16,000 employees, so it exists in a different space in the American hierarchy of educational institutions. But I've said this, I'm going to say this, you'll hear me today say this, that dynamic institutions find the resources to support their activities. And so the lessons I would bring here would be to make sure that we are proud of what we do and that we articulate it in a clear way to the outside world, that we're willing to take intellectual risks. It goes back down a little bit to the conversation we were having about free speech a moment ago. But we will find the resources to support this institution because we will be able to connect with people who see that the activities here are making a difference to the students and making the difference to society as our students go out and graduate. That's why the last capital campaign was successful, and it is a springboard, I think, to a broader conversation about the role of this college, again, not just here on the campus, but the role of the college more broadly. And part of my job is to be the amplifier of that, to be out there in the world talking about the work that you all have done with the newspaper and how that has changed the way in which the campus relates to the newspaper, the other intellectual work that is being done by the faculty and the students. That's one of the exciting aspects of this job. Fundraising is, at the end of the day, a great mechanism to just tell the story of and one of the things I think I can do is to connect with people and really get them to understand why I find this place so compelling and why, to your first question, I've come down here and want to be part of this community.
Mm-hmm. I want to turn a little bit to your tenure at Harvard. One subject that's been in the news a lot lately is a pending lawsuit about the university's admissions practices. Just for background for folks, a group representing several Asian American applicants has sued the university alleging unfair racial discrimination, and some have suggested that this lawsuit calls into question the legality of affirmative action. I don't want to ask you to comment specifically on the pending litigation, but I do want to ask more broadly what you believe the role of affirmative action in higher education institutions is in 2019.
So, Ben, we talked a little bit about this a moment ago, that a central priority of this institution, in my view, and of any good educational institution, is to create a community where there are a broad range of perspectives, of life experiences, where there is true diversity. Because it is from that diversity where we're most likely to be able to test our assumptions and become better. And so the consideration of race and admissions has many objectives to it. But one of the central ones is to make sure that we are, in fact, admitting to our campuses a diverse student body that will create the environment on our campuses that permit the most dynamic educational experience to take place. So I am emphatically of the view, and have spent the last many years of my life defending that central principle that student body diversity of all types is an essential component to an effective liberal arts education, and that this case is largely designed to threaten the ability of institutions like Gettysburg and other institutions across American higher education to achieve that objective. And so I am incredibly proud of the work I have done and the role that I have played in defending a core value, not just for the institution I currently serve, but this is something that I think transcends American higher education. And so this has been good work, it has been important work, and it's work that I think will very much translate into what I want to do here on this campus.
Piggybacking off of that, talk a little bit about some of the takeaways and lessons from your work on Harvard's President's Task Force on Inclusion and Belonging.
So it was important work. It's work that we are going to do here. It's work that you all have been doing. Part of what it takes is intentionality, right? That there are two aspects to creating that dynamic educational environment we've been talking about. One aspect is the statistical factor of diversity. Do you have different groups, different perspectives, different life experiences represented on the campus? That's important. I think a phrase I've used elsewhere is it's necessary but not sufficient. Then the question becomes, once you have these people on campus, what do you do to make sure that they are full members of the community? What do you do to make sure that the institution recognizes that it's not the same institution it was 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago? And that, like all of what we're trying to do, that we continue to evolve alongside with the times. And so part of our work here, part of our work in other institutions, is to recognize the obligation we have to be self-conscious, to stop and pause and look at what we're doing, to make sure that we are paying attention to the students on our campus today, the students who want our campus tomorrow, and creating the educational environment that will ultimately let them do what we want them to do and what they want to do when they came here. And there's a lot of lessons. We don't have the time to get into all of them here. There are a lot of lessons that emerge from the work. But at the end of the day, what we're going to need to do goes back to a number of conversations we'll have. We need to do what's right for this campus that works for this culture and that is going to be most effective in meeting the students on our campus today.
And kind of going back to this institution, one of the things we did in preparing for this interview was soliciting questions from across the campus community, and we received a great number of submissions, and I think the topic that came up in at least half of them was the issue of Greek life. And folks have taken notice of the work that you were involved in at Harvard, that I think the verb I keep using is curtailed, because it wasn't really a prohibition on single-sex organizations, but certainly it changed the incentive structure for students to participate in them. Talk a little bit about what you think made that the right decision at Harvard, and then more broadly about your posture towards the Greek community of Gettysburg, which I'm sure you know has more than 40% of students as members of organizations.
So I'm going to repeat something I said a moment ago, and that is one of the great charms of American higher education. One of the reasons why, if you look abroad, American higher education remains one of the shining beacons where people want to come to the United States to get education. One of the reasons for that is that there is a wide variety, there are a wide variety of institutions that one has available. You can go to a small liberal arts college or a big research university, you go to a public institution or a private institution, you can go to a secular or a sectarian institution. Each of these institutions has their own culture. Each of them has their own beliefs, their own objectives of what they're seeking to accomplish. And what Harvard did because of the distinctive history that exists at Harvard. What Harvard did because of the facts and circumstances on the ground as it related to the issues that were confronting our students on our community at that point. It is not a broad statement about the wisdom or not of Greek life. It is not some broad national proposition, as distinct from the conversation we had about race-conscious admissions, where we are emphatically making a statement about what we think is right for us, but we know other institutions believe in. The judgments that we made were very specific to Harvard. What is right for Gettysburg is what is right for Gettysburg. But here's my commitment. My commitment is, and you would expect, I hope, nothing more from me or from the administration. We want to make sure that this is the best student experience can be for the students at Gettysburg. And my obligation, my responsibility, my joy is to work with you all to make sure that we're doing what we can to make sure it's a great experience. And that's my commitment.
What is your animating principle, I guess you could say, with respect to crafting that student experience at an undergraduate institution?
It's a really good question, Ben. People told me you'd ask really good questions. It starts, I think, in the first instance by meeting students where they are. I mean, one of the challenges I think all of us have is we see the world through the lens of our own eyes and through the lens of our own experience. And so the undergraduate experience I had now, yes, very many, many years ago, some 40 years ago, was superb. But it was superb for that moment in time. You all have grown up in a different moment in time. You have a different relationship, for example, with technology, just to use that as one example. Your interactions with each other are different than the interactions that may have existed a generation ago. And I think an effective education starts with a recognition that we need to constantly be asking ourselves, what do we need to do today to most effectively reach the students, not only where they are, but also an awareness of the changes that are taking place in society outside our gates. And so it's sort of a bilateral responsibility. Where are you? Where are we trying to get you to go? The foundation is the same. We believe in the skills that emerge from a liberal arts education. That was true when Gettysburg was founded. It is true today, and those essential skills remain enduring. But how they're tested, how they get evolved, that needs to change, and that needs to change to accommodate the times that we live in. And that, I think, is the first way into the question that you asked.
Another question we received from the campus community, and I want to read this one directly. President Riggs is a legend on campus. How do you plan on making your own impact at Gettysburg while knowing that in the early years, many of your decisions and actions will be directly compared to your predecessors?
So I'm inclined to joke and say I'm changing my initials to JMR, and that's for sure. But I think that probably isn't fully the right answer. First of all, what a privilege it is, if you're in my shoes, to succeed a president who has been so phenomenally successful. If you have the job that I have, you want to be at an institution that is strong, that is forward-looking, that is ambitious, and following from President Riggs's tenure gives me the opportunity to take this institution where it is and to build on it. So I regard the remarkable success she has had as nothing but an asset for me, but more importantly, because this isn't about me, for the institution as a whole. I regard it as a furthermore unbelievable resource that I have, that she will be available to help me understand the place and to help advise me. At the end of the day, I am me, and President Riggs is President Riggs. We will be, I think, alike in our core values for the institution. I hope we will be alike in your sense of our approachability, but I am a different person. I will approach the job undoubtedly in ways that will be different than she will, but in all instances, the goal will be the same. One of the things that I most admire about her is that it has always been about the institution. And for me, I come to this job recognizing that I am a servant of this place. I am trying to make it possible for the faculty and the students to do the best they can do here. That animated her. That's what's going to inform the way in which I want to approach the presidency.
I think one of the things that people have most appreciated about President Reagan's leadership style is her sense of inclusiveness in making important decisions for the future of the institution. How would you approach, talk about your leadership style and how you'll approach making large decisions and then also handling the inevitable occurrence when people disagree with those decisions?
If one's goal is to be the most popular person one wants to be, one should not take these jobs because you're going to make decisions. Some of those decisions will resonate with some people and not resonate with others. That's the nature of the job. But in any educational environment, we act by virtue of reason, by virtue of conversation. And so, particularly in an institution with a strong set of principles about shared governance and the role of the faculty in defining the institution, it is not an institution that gets managed by fiat. It's an institution that gets managed by engagement, by presenting the issues, having conversations. Going back to the very first thing I said about what I want to do, which is to listen and to learn, that job doesn't end, right? That is a continuous obligation that the president has. So my job is to be out there listening, learning, persuading, building coalitions, getting people to understand what we're seeing. A good president is ultimately working collaboratively with the community, but of course, at the end of the day, decisions need to be made, and it can't be a distributed veto, where if one person is unhappy, that resolves the question. We have to do what is best for the institution. We come to the judgment about what is best for the institution by listening broadly, and to our point about free expression, making sure that we are not captured by our own orthodoxy, but we're hearing issues in a full enough way to make sure that we're seeing all of their complexity and nuance.
I want to ask two more questions. The second to last question also came from our submission, and perhaps this is the most fraught subject I'll ask you about today. Here's the question. Does pineapple belong on pizza or not?
So I happen to like pineapple, and so yes, I'm sorry to say for that part of the cohort who disagrees with me. See, I'm already disappointing half of the campus. Yes, I like pineapple. And one of the things I do is make homemade pizza from scratch. And so for those of you who do not believe that pineapple belongs to pizza, on pizza, and I see some shaking heads in this room, I'm going to have you over when I move in, and we will have to test that proposition.
Sounds like a fair and equitable decision. Last question, and to close maybe on a little bit more of a serious note, what would you view as the marks of a successful first year of your presidency at Gettysburg College? What are the measures of success that we can look back on July 1, 2020 and say it was or it was not a successful first year?
So it will not surprise you, given the conversation we've had up to now, that the single most important thing I have in front of me is to introduce myself more fully to the campus, to understand the campus more fully, and to begin to work with the faculty, with the board, with the administrative staff, with the students, to sketch out the future. And so the single most important thing to me is to get to the point where I can begin to define in my own sense the right set of priorities for my presidency, what I need to do as president, and begin to work with the community about defining those priorities for the institution as a whole.
President-elect Robert Uliana, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's On Target this week. We'd like to thank Robert Uliano for being our featured guest today.
We would also like to thank the staff of the Gettysburgian and the executive board of WZBT for their ongoing support in this project. Please be sure to subscribe to On Target on Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you get your podcasts.
On Target is a joint production of the Gettysburgian and WZBT. Our theme music was composed by Diego Rocha, senior music major focusing on composition in the Sunderman Conservatory of Music. Be sure to join us next week. We'll sit down with John Keefe, the president of the New Jersey State Bar Association and a Gettysburg College alumnus. Until then, have a great week.